I'm wrong. Yankee State.
A reading from 1 Corinthians chapter 3, beginning at verse 1. The church and its leaders. Brothers and sisters, I could not address you as people who live by the Spirit, but as people who are still worldly, mere infants in Christ. I gave you milk, not solid food, for you are not yet ready for it. Indeed, you are still not ready. You are still worldly. For since there is jealousy and quarreling among you, are you not worldly? Are you not acting like mere humans? For when one says, I follow Paul, and another, I follow Apollos, are you not mere human beings? What, after all, is Apollos? And what is Paul? Only servants, through whom you came to believe, as the Lord has assigned to each his task. I planted the seed, Apollos watered it, but God was making it grow. So neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow. The one who plants and the one who waters have one purpose, and they will each be rewarded according to their own labor. For we are co-workers in God's service. You are God's field, God's building. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. Whakarongo ki te kupu a te wairua ki te hahi. Kia mal tonu tana kupu kia tātou. The Holy Gospel, according to Matthew chapter 5, beginning at verse 21. Praise and glory to God. Te whakamoe miti, te karoria, ki te ātua. Murder. You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment. Again, anyone who says to a brother or sister, Raka, is answerable to the court. And anyone who says, you fool, will be in danger of the fire of hell. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar, and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First, go and be reconciled to them, then come and offer your gift. Settle matters quickly with your adversary who is taking you to court. Do it while you are still together on the way, or your adversary may hand you over to the judge, and the judge may hand you over to the officer, and you may be thrown into prison. Truly, I tell you, you will not get out until you have paid the last penny. Adultery. You have heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to stumble, gouge it out and throw it away. It is better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. If your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. It has been said, anyone who divorces his wife must give her a certificate of divorce. But I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, makes her the victim of adultery, and anyone who marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Again, you have heard that it was said to the people long ago, do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made. But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by the earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. And do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond this comes from the evil one. This is the gospel of Christ. Te rongopai tene a te kuraiti. Praise to Christ the Word. Whakamoe miti tia ia te kupu mana.
Kia ora koutou, good morning. And my first question was going to be, am I on? But boy, am I on. I can hear myself, yeah. Hey, it's good to be here at the beginning of a new year, or it feels like a new year for me, February. I suspect a number of us are just sort of getting back into the rhythm of life with school back this week, or the last couple of weeks. So we're continuing here on the series on Sermon on the Mount. Steve's just whispered in my ear, he said, oh gee, you've got a tough gig, don't you? Like, murder and adultery. And then we will maybe touch on this, but actually I want to look a little bit bigger at this picture here, and I want to pick up on a little bit on what Mark talked about the purpose of the sermon. First century context here, Jesus is a Jewish rabbi, and he's interpreting the law. So he begins here by saying, you have heard it said. Those who are standing around him are used to hearing the law being interpreted. And so he's saying, hey, this is what you've heard it said, but then he's offering his own interpretation on it. And his interpretation here is radical. The word radical comes from the Latin word meaning the roots of something. And what Jesus is doing here is he's not sort of finding the loopholes and the extrications of ways we can slip around the law, but rather he's digging down to reveal the true roots, the intention or the spirit of the law. And so in those two examples there within, or the three within that passage there, he talks about murder, and he says murder, in one sense, is not... He wants people to think here that murder is not the action of murder, but actually what he wants you to think about is the intentions, the attitudes that lead to that action. The sense of dehumanizing and treating the other as no longer a person who is worthy of one's respect. And he says, actually, the issue here is... the murder flows from the beginning origins of that, which is instead of saying, I am my brother's keeper, of saying, you fool. That's the seeds of that murderous act. The fact that you have begun to understand that other person as a fool. Likewise here, adultery. The discussion here is not on what constitutes adultery so much as asking what's going on behind this action. A recognition here in the first century context that what's going on is that a Jewish woman is no longer being seen as one's neighbour, as a fellow Jew, as one to be respected and loved, but rather as being seen as a second-class citizen, as being constituted by, well, what do I get out of this? How does this meet my needs and desires? Well, this isn't meeting my needs and desires anymore, so I can just move them on. And so there's a dehumanisation here that's taking place. Jesus' teaching here, particularly around adultery and then around questions of divorce, are really radical within the context of his day, within the customs of his day. And then, in fact, later on in Matthew 19, he comes into conversation with the Pharisees about this when they want to discuss, well, how do we understand these laws and customs regarding divorce? And Jesus here, it's really important here to note here, is that Jesus is not speaking in a 21st century context. And he's not saying, therefore, that a woman should stay with an abusive man in a relationship. But rather, he's noting within this context about the way in which women are treated as a commodity and are passed on and moved on. And he is calling that into question and saying, this runs contrary to the Torah, to the law that God has given us. And so for Matthew's understanding here of Jesus, Jesus is a Mosaic figure. He is an interpreter of the law. And the key thing I want you to think about here is this is a radical nature of interpretation. As Mark said last week, Jesus is strengthening law. He is pushing it to its deepest realities. He is asking his listeners then and today to ask, what is the spirit? What is the attitude? What is the posture that one needs to have if one is going to be a worshipper of God? Some suggest, therefore, that what's going on here is that Jesus is less an interpreter of the law than a moral perfectionist. That is, he is calling people to some form of moral perfection. Theologically, during church history, therefore, there's been two ways of interpreting this passage or of emphasizing this passage, or you could say two types. And when we speak about typologies, you often sort of, you paint them as really black and white, so they become really obvious caricatures. And so I'm going to suggest to you that there's two types of way of reading this, recognizing here that this is not nuance, this is just holding up two things to contrast them. The first is that through church history, what's tended to happen is that we've spoken about this passage, the Sermon on the Mount, as Jesus is drawing attention to our intentions and our attitudes that lie behind our ethical actions. And that in doing so, therefore, what he does is he draws attention to our own sinfulness. Because actually, deep down, our intentions are never pure. And so some commentators suggest that, therefore, what's going on is the Sermon on the Mount essentially is an impossible ideal. Therefore, Jesus is painting this impossible ideal about the ways in which we are meant to live. And that because it's an impossible ideal, therefore, this throws us again back upon the grace of God, that we recognize our own brokenness, and then we approach God by the grace of Jesus Christ and ask for his mercy. So that is type one. Type two says, no, this is a sermon, this is an ethical manifesto. It's about the way in which we live our lives. And so therefore, Jesus is calling his followers to say, this is the way you should live. This is the way your ethics should be lived out. You are called to live in this way because this is a countercultural way of living in contrast to the world. Okay, so those two different typologies. So type one, you could say, is focused on sort of a theological truth, which is that Jesus is less offering a set of ethics for us so much as pointing out to us our own brokenness and sinfulness. Type two says, well, actually, no, what's going on here is that Jesus is calling us to sort of be ethical followers, to be transformed in the way in which we live our life. When we hold these two ways sort of apart from each other, or if we overemphasize them, it sort of becomes a little bit problematic, because type one suggests that we just see this as some sort of theological truth, which means that we ignore the fact that it's full of the way we're meant to live ethically, which is talking about our ethics. But if we talk primarily about it as sort of this ethical set of instructions about how we live, we seem to downplay the fact here that the person who's interpreting the law is not just a ethical rule giver, but is actually Jesus, God-man, come in flesh, not just the interpreter of law, but the embodiment of the law. And at worst, when we stress that, what happens is Jesus becomes simply an ethical moral teacher to us, who's offering a blueprint for the ways in which we should live our life. And this is the ways in which all of humanity is called to live our life. We should be people of universal brotherhood. And so about 100 years ago in the early 20th century, there was a strong emphasis on reading this ethical text and saying, this is summoning in us to recognize our universal brotherhood. Of course, this was pre-feminism. Nowadays, we'd say our universal personhood with each other. This was a big emphasis for this is the way we should live, except the difficulty was we didn't live like this, and the world doesn't live like this. And so then the discussion became, well, maybe actually the problem is that this sermon is not for the world, but it's actually primarily for the church. Actually, what Jesus is doing is he's offering the ethical injunctions to us as the people of God. Of course, this then raises a whole set of questions, which is, but what happens when the church doesn't live out this radical new way of living? What happens when it ceases to be an ethical people? Does that mean it ceases to be an authentic church? And what about the fact that large numbers of people who don't say that they follow Jesus and actually have very little time for the church live in ways which are much more akin to the Sermon on the Mount than many of us who live and inhabit the church. That is, that many people outside the church live lives of greater commitment to justice, peace, compassion and mercy for others than those of us within the church. And so this leads to sort of some odd questions, difficult questions. Type one, by seeing this text only as theological truth, tends to talk about the continuity between the church and the world, recognising here that the sermon draws us back to our own brokenness and therefore calls us to put ourselves before God for his mercy. Type two, big strong emphasis here on ethics, tends to see a discontinuity between the church and the world and says, actually, the church is meant to be radically different from the world. You're meant to live as a sort of this radical different community to sort of the broken, sinful world. Except we're also broken, sinful people. So, in our current context, you might want to think, therefore, about which of those emphasis tends to be given, type one or type two? What's our current moment? Which of those do you think gets more airplay? Type two? Yep, that'd be my reading at the moment. We're going through a period, both I think within the church, but within broader society, with a strong emphasis on our ethical behaviour. Some suggest that we're moving into a period of sort of moral puritanism. There's a sense in which we all now want to watch and observe each other and determine whether people are living ethical lives. Ecological awareness, am I living a green enough life? Awareness of our sins of colonisation, of racism, of my treatment of minorities within society, whether it be women, disabled, or those of different sexual orientation. All these questions are constantly going on, which is, but are you on that side or are you not on that side? Are you living an ethical life or are you not living an ethical life? Do I need to call you out on that behaviour? That was totally homophobic. That's totally inappropriate. Except it's probably going to be a lot more damning than just sort of calling out. It's probably going to be much more abrasive. Arguably, perhaps for a greater time maybe than previous in human existence, we're living in this time where there's a sense in which this Christian ideal of calling, or a Judeo-Christian understanding of calling people to an ethical life, has actually been taken on by society, but it's kind of now on steroids. It's like, oh my goodness. And we used to think that we were judgmental, the church. Holy smoke, this is difficult living in this context. And so we talk about the church living as a counterculture reality, and yet the reality is now we live in this world where actually this is the norm. This is the sea that we live and work and breathe in. I want us to therefore just briefly think therefore about what the sort of the difficulties of this are. I want to suggest here that this is a text that reminds us again as people of God that we are people of integrity. We are meant to walk the talk. But by an overemphasis on type two, it does also lead to some difficulties. That is, the overwhelming emphasis tends to become on our ethical actions. We start discussing and thinking about the ways in which we act. The emphasis is on our behaviour. And so there is an irony that takes place here, which is the Sermon on the Mount, which is about the law, and about the fact that we can't live by the law, now becomes a new law that we have to live and be held to. And rather than the text drawing us back to discussing our attitudes and our postures, we then have to discuss, but is my behaviour in this situation appropriate or inappropriate? The sermon here is meant to draw our attention to the roots that are underneath the tree, but we're looking at the branches on the tree, you could say. And so the evidence of one's righteousness or our radical desire to follow Jesus, therefore, becomes a set of activities that we think should be exhibited by those who are following Jesus. The sign that we are a real spirit-filled, countercultural community or Christian is going to be outworked in a certain set of behaviours. But of course, those behaviours and those expectations change over time and in different cultural contexts. So you might want to think about your own lifetimes. I'm thinking about my own lifetime. The first example may be slightly before my time, but some of you will remember growing up where to be an ethical person living a good ethical life, one attended church every Sunday. You didn't drink. You didn't smoke. You didn't play cards. And you absolutely didn't dance. And some of you think, oh, yep, that sounds like what appropriate Christian behaviour was, particularly for young people. And then later on, maybe the appropriate Christian behaviour, the way in which we exhibited our radicalness for Jesus, was the fact that we sang choruses rather than hymns, that we spoke in tongues, and that we headed overseas for mission, that we gave up our lives to head overseas for mission. Today, what is the exhibit that we're living radical lives? It might be that we live in intentional community, that we give up our vocational careers to do real ministry, that we drive electric cars, that we drink fair trade coffee, that we only purchase secondhand clothes from Salvation Army, that we don't use single-use plastic, that we use only gender-neutral language of God, and that we shun comfort and security. But of course, while one group's saying that, the other group is saying, well, actually, the authentic demonstration of the fact that I'm living radically here for Jesus' ethical life is the fact that I'm going to be pro-marriage, and therefore I'm going to be probably quite strident in my views about sexuality. I'm going to be very anti-abortion. I'm absolutely not going to watch liberal media, and I'm probably going to vote for the Republicans or the National Party. And so you'll see here that our prescriptions about the ways in which we should live are highly determined by the cultural context in which we live in and by the groups that we're with and or the historical moment that we live in. And so that every generation or era, we have a new set of criteria about what appropriate behaviour should look like. What is the evidence of our integrity? And so there becomes this either implicit or explicit new set of norms for how we should live an ethical life. Now, again, my emphasis here I want to suggest is that we are called to an ethical life, but I want you to note here the subtle shift from our discussion last week from Mark, who spoke very poignantly and powerfully about going to a funeral. And at the end of that funeral, what struck him was not the ethical outworkings of this person's life, though that works out, but fundamentally about love, about the fact that there was this deep well and nourishment of love which had then flowed out into a range of actions and ways of treating people. So my suggestion here is not that we're called to lives of justice, mercy and peace and love, but just noting the ways in which we can then sometimes become obsessed with the ways in which that is characterised. Noting here, therefore, that throughout church history there has been divergence and expressions of different ways of living this radical obedience. And we see this right from the very origins of Christianity. So that passage from 1 Corinthians 3 that was read out to us by Ian, right from the beginning here, the church of Corinth is beginning to split around who is with who. We hang out with Paul, we follow Paul, we follow Apollos. Well, we like Paul because Paul's into this. Yeah, well, we like Apollos because Apollos is into this. And so right from the start here, you have the church is beginning to galvanize itself around strong personalities, people who are part of their tradition. And I can imagine that what's going on here is a discussion around who is the more radical or who is the more authentic. So I want to stress here again, don't get me wrong, we are called, I think, as the people of God to live people of lives of justice, mercy and compassion. But to recognise here that the fundamental thing that's going on in the sermon is calling us again back to our posture and our attitudes that drive that transformation. So some problems, therefore, with this, I suggest, overemphasis within our current culture on the outworkings or the ethical demonstration, and in particular for us as a church. The first is that, and I've touched on these, the first is that it's somewhat hubristic. The word hubris is foolish, the idea that we think beyond ourselves. And this idea here, therefore, that the church is going to become the social agent of transformation within our society. the idea that the raison d'etre, the reason for the existence of the church, is to be a social transformation movement. And that if we simply, just as the church, lived out our ethics in radical ways, that will bring transformation. In particular, a transformation of a certain socio-political cultural agenda. And I want to say that's a little bit foolish. The second thing I want to suggest that's why this is problematic is the idea is to recognise that the church is never pure. We don't have a monopoly on being ethical. The church is never pure. And in fact, it's very difficult to live pure ethical lives because we are caught up in the intricacies and complexities of a very messy, broken world. Thinking about this week, at the beginning of the week, we commemorate the Treaty of Waitangi. For those who are not Māori, which include me, the reality is my life is easier because I'm not Māori. Because my life is not shaped by the systemic structural issues that have gone on for 180 years within Aotearoa New Zealand. I probably live on stolen land, but the reality is I can't give that land back because where else would I go? And so it becomes a complicated reality of saying we need to recognise these things and we need to address them, but also saying, but I can't just then say, well, I'm going to live a pure life. Well, I can't live a pure life because I'm enmeshed and entangled in those complexities. Also recognising that when we treat these things in sort of a pure and non-pure way is that we create the very thing that we talked about at the beginning. We say, well, this person is pure, and those people who are not pure get dehumanised and they become another. But all of us are enmeshed and broken and pure people in some ways. Maybe another example, maybe I should go buy an electric car, except they're very expensive and all the rare metals come from Congo or from the Altiplano in Bolivia. And so I might buy an electric car and feel ethically good about that, but the difficulty is that I'm still enmeshed in a whole lot of other complexities, which is poor communities around the world who are extricating minerals on my behalf and therefore desecrating their own lands. So, what am I trying to say here? Recognise here that we live in a current where there's a strong emphasis on ethics and that I'm suggesting here that pushed to extremes, this can be problematic. One, because of hubris. One, because it puts the focus on the sense in that we can somehow live pure lives. But I want to suggest that the greatest danger of this typology is that it loses our attention, because our attention now shifts from Jesus to ourselves. The focus is not on who is Jesus and what is he doing in this world, and becomes who are we and what are we doing in this world. We cease to narrate the story of who Jesus is historically and narrate the story of where we've seen the signs of God at work in this world, and we begin to narrate our own story about how ethically pure we are and why people should be more like us. I want to suggest, therefore, that these two types, the critical thing is holding these two ways of thinking about the sermon together. That fundamentally what's going on is we're summoned to be people of integrity, to recognise that we are not pure people. Two brief examples here to finish, and then a closing reflection. The first is, as I read this passage, I find it deeply, deeply challenging. Because after 40 years plus of trying to follow Jesus, I recognise the extent to which I lack patience and how I am prone to anger. And I think, geez, do you know what? In other contexts, I wonder where that would lead me. The second reflection here is the story of Lash. Some of you will be familiar with the story of Lash. Candace, who is the director of Lash in Kapiti, and others who work at Lash, are part of the Lash community, worship here. Lash was set up by a Canadian Catholic priest in the 1960s called Jean Vanier. And when he died in 2019, people said, wow, what a legacy Jean Vanier leaves to the world. This amazing set of communities around the world of disabled people who live together in community with others. This is a beacon to the world. Except after his death, it then became revealed that actually there was a shadow side to Jean Vanier, that while he wrote these profound books about the importance of human community for developing authentic, loving relationships, that he was a deeply flawed human being who, over the course of decades, had been involved in inappropriate relationships with 25-plus women, abusive relationships. A report was released a couple of weeks ago, and the report writers, which were academics who had been asked to do some research here to begin to tell this other side of the last story, they argue that actually the primary motivation for the establishment of the very first L'Arche community in France in 1964 was not, as Jean Vanier claimed, because he felt this sense of God's cry for those who were living in institutions who were disabled, but rather it was set up because Jean Vanier wanted to protect a Dominican Catholic priest who had already been accused of abuse, and that this was a way of him and other supporters creating a community that would somehow support but also distract from these accusations. So the story of this profound, pure, ethical Christian leader has, since his death, been exposed as anything but. And yet what is most powerful about this story, what is most profound, is that in the shocking and terrible reality is that Christ's light has still shone. Because despite the impurity and brokenness of Jean Vanier, L'Arche has flourished around the world. There are now 150 communities in 35 countries, and the report overwhelmingly says what took place here with this inner sanctum of people was confined to this inner sanctum. And actually, this profound thing called L'Arche seems to have somehow been insulated or inoculated. Love has somehow inoculated itself from this evil that was at the heart of this inner group. And so those who said at the end of Vanier's life, who spoke of L'Arche being his legacy to the world, perhaps a much more accurate description is L'Arche is the legacy of Christ's love being manifest in the world. What I'm trying to suggest here, therefore, is that even in our impurity and our inability to live ethical lives, we're called to that, and yet somehow God is still at work in our brokenness when we come before him. And perhaps the best way to instantiate, to ground what I'm saying here is as we come to the Eucharist. We come to a table which is both very human element, but is also a divine feast. In the Middle Ages, there was great controversy about what makes the sacraments effective realities of grace. How are these instruments of grace for us? And some said, we have to therefore raise questions about the purity of the priest. Is the person who's administering those sacraments living an ethical life? Or is it the purity of the elements themselves? That is, can one eat bread and wine that has been grown and harvested by slaves? Or is it the purity of the ritual? That is, if we follow the appropriate conventions for the way in which we undertake Eucharist, does that make it pure as therefore a giver of grace? Or is it the purity and integrity of those of us who are coming to receive it? Does that make it effective? And the church said, no, the effectiveness of the sacraments is found not in the priest, not in the elements, not in the ritual, not in the participants, but because this is Christ's table. Christ is present. This is the law come in human flesh. This is the law, the ethical perfection of God come real in the world. And so we come to the table, and we're invited to come to the table to eat bread that reminds us again of Christ's brokenness and of our brokenness. And we come to the table, therefore, again to offer ourselves as broken vessels and to ask that God, as we eat that bread and are nourished by that bread, may become more whole people, more integrated people, people who more clearly live out lives of justice, mercy, compassion, become people who, through the power of the Spirit, are more able to be a radical community who live out the Sermon on the Mount. We are, as Paul says, we are God's field. We are God's building. But ultimately, it is God who is doing the work within us, who is transforming us by the power of Spirit. Amen.
Thank you, Andrew. Really challenging, but a really clear message at the end. Please stand for our next worship song.